The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Christine Porath. Christine is Associate Professor of Management at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University. She is also a consultant working with leading organizations to help them solve the vexing problem of incivility. Her speaking and consulting clients include Google, the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, and Genentech. She has written a new book. It's called Mastering Civility, A Manifesto for the Workplace. Christine Porath, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So early in your book, you cite a 2016 survey, which says that in America, 95% of those surveyed feel that we have a civility problem, and 74% felt it was worse now than it had been a few years ago, and 70% believed incivility has reached crisis proportions. And before we jump to the contention that just because someone feels that way doesn't make it true, you make the important note that, quote, incivility is in the eyes of the recipient. So true or not, this is how people feel today in our country, and that's hugely important.
Yeah, it's sad, too, you know, because I see the numbers only increasing, really.
Yeah. It's part now our public conversation seems to be based in sort of in civil communication.
Absolutely. And I think the online only contributes to people feeling this way as well.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. I want to talk about the origins of incivility. So you say that, yes, technology is something that's straining workplace relationships. And that's just not the anonymity of, you know, some of our social media accounts. It's other sort of digital usage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's people not paying attention to each other. Because they're, you know, tethered to their phones or their laptops, always feeling like you have to be on email. So feeling like you're pulled in multiple directions, I think, leads people to be shorter with others, not only online, but just in general, you know, not paying attention and stuff like that.
Yeah, I read a study once that if you just have a cell phone even turned over in front of you, like on the desk where you're talking to someone, that your level of communication decreases.
Yeah, I heard about a similar study with the phone on a table where also, you know, even if you don't know it's the other person, you trust them and like them less. So
oh, really?
Even if they're not on it, Yeah, it's you're making judgments about, you know, the fact that they're not tuning into you completely, and therefore, you know, you think a lot worse of them.
All right, so here's another origin of incivility, again, sad, globalization and generational differences.
Yeah, so I think one thing is that because we tend to work and live in more diverse environments, what tends to happen is we all bring different norms to the table. So, you know, we use, for example, email very differently and speak very directly or indirectly on it. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to a lot of misunderstandings. And then, you know, to your point about generation differences, we grew up with different norms. So, you know, especially in the workplace where I do a lot of the research, people find a lot of issues with that. You know, Some people, for example, to your technology point, you know, think it's great to be on their phone all the time during meetings and so forth. Other people think that's totally disrespectful.
Yeah, completely. And I'm like, I'm so tired of millennial bashing, which seems to be like it's going to be an Olympic sport, you know, at some point.
Right.
Because and it's funny, the futurist Bob Johansson was on the show and he said, you know, generations actually are very similar in most of the important ways. The differences always start at where they begin. And I know this difference between I have a 15-year-old and 20-year-old and their relationship to social media, for example, is very different simply because my younger younger one already had some, you know, people made mistakes. My son made the mistakes that she didn't have to deal with when she, you know, was around to using her device.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really tough. But I think, you know, there are a lot of complaints about this, as you mentioned, you know, especially in the workplace, just getting used to each other, you know, and how we operate differently.
So there's a cost to incivility. It is unhealthy. Is that accurate to say?
Yes. So it's extremely stressful for people that experience this, especially if it, you know, is there's a track record of it. You know, they're experiencing it often.
So, you literally say it can deplete your immune system. We're not just talking like in you know, sort of, I don't know, metaphor here. It can physically affect you.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's some interesting research out of Harvard Medical School that looked at women that worked for more toxic bosses. And what they found is that it was worse for their health than obesity. So I think it puts it in perspective, you know, and there's a lot of great stress research that just shows that like 1,000 paper cuts, you know, that you just that add up. And sometimes we assume it shouldn't affect us, but it really does go away at our immune system such that we're more prone to, you know, get cancer or have a heart attack or things like that.
Right, right. And so, yeah, unhealthy for workers, but also there's a financial cost. And you note that the American Psychological Association, they put that cost, I couldn't believe this, in the area of $500 billion a year. And I guess that's lack of productivity and workplace accidents. You talk about actual medical areas in that field.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've worked with hospitals that have estimated it into the hundreds of millions just, you know, in their hospital healthcare system. So it adds up quickly. Probably the biggest and most hidden cost is around turnover or, you know, the people leaving their jobs because of this and often not reporting it. So that really rises, you know, in terms of the cost and so forth.
I was at in New York speaking at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and I got to this, and I talk a lot about in improvisation, you know, you practice failure and risk, and you sort of maintain a healthy relationship with those things. And the head of, I think it was the head of HR afterwards, he and I were having a conversation, and he said, you know, a lot of people think that you could never talk about that in a medical situation, but 90% of the decisions that go on in a medical institution are not related to, like, you know, in the emergency room. It's stuff happening, you know, at the decisions they're making made in the boardroom and all that. So even a place like that, confronting those kinds of problems is important.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the consequences are no more severe than in the healthcare context. You know, I've had stories shared with me from doctors about how, you know, after a physician shouted at a medical team, the entire team missed information on a patient's chart and gave the wrong dosage of medication. And that resulted in the patient's death. And we hear a lot of these kind of stories where patient errors are being made, not obviously intentionally, but just, you know, we're not focused because other things like the rudeness are pulling us off track. Even if it doesn't happen to us, we're just working around it.
That's tremendous. Okay, so we talked a lot about a bunch of negatives, but let's talk about civility in action, because you cite like Costco as a company that gets civility right. What do they do?
Well, I think it stems from the founder, Jim Senegal, who really set the tone for treating people right, not only in terms of benefits and everything, but he's notorious for walking around, you know, and talking to people, saying hello. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, people just want those common courtesies where they feel like they matter. Mm-hmm. And so I think it really comes down to a lot of the little things, although in their case, they also, you know, have a lot of policies in place such that they provide health care and things like that. I mean, they do a lot that makes people feel valued, mm-hmm. but oftentimes it really does come down to little things, paying attention, listening to people, saying hello, smiling, you know, when you greet them, things like that.
And so this seems to play into the term that feels like it's a daily term that comes up now, which is psychological safety, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So talk to us about that, because not everyone understands what psychological safety is and gets confused about it, but it's kind of crucially important.
Yeah, so the whole idea is that people feel like there's a sense of trust or respect, that they're comfortable speaking up about problems or issues and so forth. And again, a lot of this initial research was done in healthcare. And so, you know, it was teaching medical students, and one of them shared how there was a doctor who was always, you know, respectful to everyone, regardless of their status. And in the surgery, there was a nurse that spoke up when they were about to give the wrong dosage of medication, and she immediately questioned it in terms of his weight and so forth and if it was appropriate. And, you know, he listened to her and, you know, saved the patient basically as a result. And he gave her an award. I mean, she won a system-wide award, but she felt comfortable speaking up, whereas there's been a lot of examples where people don't question authority, especially in, you know, healthcare or areas where there's huge power differences because they're afraid. And so what you want is people really feeling comfortable to question things, to bring potential issues, potential risks, and so forth. And where the research was originally done was around cardiac surgeon teams and the idea of quickly perfecting, you know, a new way to do open heart surgery. It wasn't the most talented doctors. It wasn't the hospitals with the most resources. What mattered most was that people felt comfortable contributing to the procedure. And so, and we see this in all fields, though. Google did a study of 180 teams over years trying to figure out, like, what's the secret recipe, mm-hmm. how we should, you know, structure these teams. People from certain backgrounds, certain smarts, IQ, emotional intelligence, things like that. What mattered most by far was a sense of psychological safety. So,
yeah, it's like those studies where you're like, why do these two people work so well together? It's that their desks are close, you know, so,
yeah.
So this is a sense of, oh, like, that's important. And that leads to this idea. We interviewed a guy a while ago, one of the early days of the podcast, and he's the vicar of St. Martin in the Fields. His name is the Reverend Dr. Samuel Wells. And he studied improvisation as it relates to Christian ethics. So that's why we had him on. And he had this really interesting take in one of his lectures that I had when I was doing research, where he says that the basic problem in the human condition used to be mortality. And that's we've kind of figured that out. And as you know, it's no longer sort of the number one problem. And he contends that the problem now, the number one problem, is isolation.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, that makes a lot of sense, because this idea of connectedness is so important. And you talk about that civility, when it happens in action, can spread to the whole organization, but it also has the opposite effect. You know, it's a virus either way, maybe a virus for good, but also a virus for bad.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we can touch the virus anywhere. I mean, mm-hmm. certainly it happens in the workplace, but I think, you know, coming back to your earliest points about, you know, it's pervasive and stuff. I mean, what we're finding is that people, if they catch outside the workplace, we bring it into the workplace and spread it there. Or if we get it at work, we take it home with us, or we take it online and troll people, you know, and things like that. So unfortunately, it's crossing over, you know, and we become carriers of it, even if we're not aware of it. So in other words, you know, if we're working in a culture where it's prevalent, where, you know, a teammate acts like that, even if it's not directly to us, chances are we take that and spread it elsewhere, you know, both in the organization, but probably outside as well.
It's interesting. You just made me think about this, and I don't think I've ever thought of it this way, because if the thing is that the guy who's like an asshole to work and that makes you bring it home, it could be that what's happening at home with that person is why they're bringing it to work. Like, it has the opposite path.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it flows both ways. And so that's why, you know, to me, it's not just a workplace problem. It's, you know, sadly, it's a societal issue.
Yeah, it's a human being
problem. We really need to get aware.
Yeah. What's actually, so you have this term brain burn, and you talk about a little bit of the neuroscience and what's happening in the brain when all this is going on?
Well, apparently it can form a tattoo on our brain, such that if we see this, let's say a boss, you know, yells at someone in their office and we're in a cubicle outside of it, you know, every time we see that office, even if the boss isn't in there or other things, because the kind of that, the flight or flight, if you will, has burned a tattoo in our brain, if just seeing his office or her office, you know, it can bring back those same feelings where we get maybe very nervous or we get very upset or we tense up and such that, like, it leaves that permanent mark and we're reminded of it in similar incidents or when we see things related to it. Mm-hmm. So it can really extend the effects such that they add up.
In this section, too, I found it fascinating when you talk about the traits of warmth and competence being the chief traits that drive the impressions we make on others. And I'm like, oh, that's great. But then you said there's a catch, and that the catch is that strength in one of those traits typically implies a weakness in the other. That's weird.
Yeah, it is weird. But if we think about a lot of examples, like the common ones are, you know, she's really friendly, but we assume she must not be smart. Or, you know, he's really, really smart, but we think he might be a jerk to work for. He's selfish, or he's, you know. And so apparently we tend to bucket people. You know, a strength in one implies a weakness in the other. So what's really kind of cool about civility is it's very unique in that it scores you wins in both. You know, those are really important traits because about 90% of the positive or negative impressions we make about people are based on this. And one of the, I think, most important takeaways is we want to lead with warmth. That's actually the primary thing people judge you on. Mm-hmm. So we first think, and this goes back to survival, you know, one, do we trust that person, you know, and two, can he or she help us? But it's about that, you know, friendly and trustworthy initially on the warmth. And so we want to make sure that we're doing the little things such that people think of us as warm and then, you know, allow us to stick around to prove our competence.
Yeah, I would imagine, too, knowing this, if you are typically a person who leads with warmth or leads with competence, you would then understand that you want to show your other hand. I mean, it's a little bit of a, you know, it's almost like a salesman's trick. Know that you need to do that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. When I'm doing a public talk, and I do this a lot, I'll often ask everyone in the audience to raise their hand if they enjoy performance reviews, receiving or giving. And you can imagine, like, literally no one raises their hand. And if one person does, it's like, who are you? We're going to use the rest of this talk to find out what is going on in your world. But feedback is huge in this area. The thing that you talk about is totally an improv thing, which is the key to providing positive feedback is to do it in the moment. So talk about it in your context, and I'll talk about it in our context.
Yeah, so I mean, I think what you want to do is catch people doing things right and immediately reinforce them, you know. And so whatever you can do, whether that's via technology, you know, shooting them a positive, or whether it's giving them a high five, or whether it's saying, that was great. But, you know, we learn based on that immediate feedback. And so peers are often actually in the best position to do that versus, like, the leader having to do it. So you really want to create a culture where that happens naturally, you know, and people are doing it often because we're lifting each other up and teach things.
So I understand that not everyone can have an audience in front of them, but one of the things we're very lucky with, especially when you're improvising comedy in front of an audience, so you're making up the script. If they laugh, you know you're doing a good job. If they don't, you know that you need to shift what you're doing. And there's no judgment in the moment. That's the great thing about that kind of feedback. It's simply like, oh no, I gotta figure out a way to make this work, and I go. So it gets more complicated when there's just one human being giving you that note directly, as opposed to, you know, it's dark and you're just sort of not hearing something or hearing something, you go. But really it is, if you can get that sort of improviser's mindset that allows you to take critique in the moment and apply it to change your behavior, what you're doing, that would be a fantastic skill to bring in the workplace.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that that's, as a leader, what you really want to encourage among teammates.
All right. So the other thing I loved in the section was this one. Quote, many HR professionals have told me that some of the best feedback they receive regarding prospective employees is from the person who drove the candidate from the airport or the receptionist who greeted the candidate at the front desk. Like, yes, 100 times yes.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, you always tell people, like, how did they treat the scheduler? You know, how did they treat the parking attendant, like you said, or the administrative assistant or what have you. So I think, you know, it really does pay to get the candidate in front of multiple people, but pay particular attention to how they treat people with less power or status, because what we find is that people kiss up and kick them.
Yep.
So you're most likely to get the best, most accurate picture from, you know, people with less power. And, you know, that's also true for how you're recruiting a candidate, like in terms of where are you getting the recommendations. I mean, most people put, you know, their three favorite friends or bosses, but it's not often that we're really sifting through it to see, well, wait a second, how did they treat people at the same level or below them?
So I told you this story to one of my colleagues, Abby Wagner, who runs our training center, and she laughed and she goes, okay, one of my first job interviews at the Chicago Theater, I had to enter through the side entrance, and the security guard, I waited with him, and then about 5 minutes later, I went up for my interview. And at the end of my interview, they went, oh, okay, so, you know, John, the security guard, actually said you were really nice, and that's when your interview started. So she literally, and I was like, this is great. And we've got this incredible, Kate Eddy, who kind of does, she helps everyone at Second City, and she's like the most awesome human being in the world. I'm like, this is the Kate Eddy test. We need to have everyone sit with her for 5 minutes. And if they're kind and they listen to her and they sort of understand what's going on, great. That's someone we should consider. And if they're opposite, no way.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I think that's super smart. And I wish more organizations employed that.
Yep. Okay, so some of the stuff that you talk about that are sort of civil behaviors are counterintuitive to sort of old school business. So you, first of all, say you should share your resources. And I think a lot of people would think, like, why would you share your resources? But no, there's a positive effect to this, right?
Absolutely. So Adam Grant has done a ton of awesome work on this. He has a great book called Give and Take. But basically what he finds is that, you know, takers, you know, are those that are that look out for themselves more. They may slightly win in the short term, depending on the situation. However, in the long term, the kind of the givers or people that at least reciprocate are much more likely to perform well. And this holds true across a lot of different industries and situations. And, you know, the research that I've done also speaks to that, that it usually pays in the long run. And so, you know, and you're more likely to be seen as a leader and so forth. Because I think a lot of people, I teach MBAs, and they're, I think, rather skeptical about being the nice guy or gal because, you know, they're afraid of being taken advantage of. And yet what we find is in industry after industry that people are twice as likely to be seen as leaders when they're perceived as civil. And, you know, they perform better as rated objectively. And so I think it does pay, but sometimes it takes a little bit more of that long-term vision, if you will, to really buy into it.
So the Adam Grant thing's hilarious because I am the beneficiary of his doing of that. So, yes, he's got the research, but he behaves like that. So, Adam, I wanted to be in touch with Jennifer Ocker at Stanford, who's been doing some stuff around comedy and laughter. And Adam's like, I know her. So he hooked us up. And then she's like, come bring your wife. My wife's a comedy professor. Come teach our class. So we went and did the class when we were in town. And then David Hornick was there, who is one of the origin stories is a venture capitalist, and Adam talks about him in Give and Take. And David's one of those rare VCs who looks to hook people up. And then he's become a friend. And now we're going to go teach comedy at the Lobby Conference in Hawaii. So I'm getting a free trip to Hawaii, thanks to Adam Grant.
Wow, that is awesome.
And it hasn't even stopped there. Like, he connected me with our friend Ai-Jen Poo, and we've created she runs an organization called the Domestic Workers Alliance, as well as Caring Across Generations. And we're building out a Improv for Care program. And that's all of this stuff happened because Adam picked up a phone, shared his resources and his people. The other thing is you talk about is sharing recognition, because that's the other thing, which is very easy to hold on to what's mine and I want the credit for it. But like when you open up yourself to this and you share it, so much more will come back to you.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you had those examples, because he's a good friend, and I've benefited tremendously as well. But the same thing has happened. You know, we've connected each other to different networks and been able to lift others up, you know, through those networks. So I think he definitely puts into practice, you know, that kind of thing. And as you mentioned, recognition is a great example where, like, why hold back? You know, I mean, yeah. It's one of these things, because I think oftentimes organizations or leaders think, well, I don't have the resources, you know, to kind of invest in the culture. But a lot of these things don't cost money.
No.
I mean, they're free, you know,
so
do them.
Yeah. And I've the last five podcasts, I've probably used the same quote, but I'm going to do it again because it's just like it hits me, it was Danny Kahneman who said that people are not so complicated. It's relationships between people that gets complicated. And you say, quote, in the end, it's relationships that matter, and civility is the foundation of relationships.
Yeah, I think it really comes down to these small moments. That's what we get, and that's what we can use to kind of either plant the seeds for relationships to grow or to kind of nurture relationships. I mean, even, you know, the marriage research and, you know, around it's the little things, you know, positive and negative, that really seem to predict whether couples stay together. And so I think the same thing applies, really, whether at the workplace or not, you know. And so if we can focus on these little things, they really make a big difference to people. And the nice thing is we're finding, like in social network research, that this spreads. So it's not only reciprocated, but you kind of pay it forward. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because if you just think about, you know, someone recognized you or so forth, you walk down the hall, you're in a better mood, you're more likely to treat someone else better. You know, it's like, it's, you know, it kind of is intuitive that way.
So I'm curious, when you do this kind of research and you're in this area and you're in the business school at Georgetown, and I don't, I'm not asking you to call out your colleagues, but honestly, right? You like, how do you manage when you see that stuff pop up? Because it's inevitable. It happens everywhere. It happens in Second City. We're groups of people and, you know, stuff happens. But what, you know, when you have to sort of, is there a way to put your research into action?
I think so. I mean, that's why I try to get it out so broadly. But, you know, I think it's also, I think the students have been really receptive to it. I mean, you have to motivate them on the why it matters, you know, and I think, again, your point with Adam's work really hits home on that front. And so really teaching them a way to do things differently. But as you mentioned, I think, you know, myself as the primary example, I mean, it's easy to have a bad moment or to not be mindful, or you don't get enough sleep and you're short. You know, the number one reason why people say they're uncivil is they're stressed. And we know that that's only increased, you know, for most people. So I think it is tough. So it's about, you know, trying to be as mindful as possible about this and catch yourself as much as possible, you know, when you're tempted or when you're ready to slip up.
Yeah. Well, and I'm curious, too, one more thing. And I'm going to ask for your yes and story next. But, it, like, did this research find you, or did you find this research? What led you to down this vein?
The research found me. It was first my dad. He had a heart attack scare over 22 years ago, and I knew that he was working for not one, but two toxic bosses over the course of a decade, but at the time, he didn't talk about it, and so, you know, he was a healthy, strong, vivacious guy, and so literally when we got the call, and I remember, you know, going to the hospital room and seeing him in the bed with electrodes strapped to his bare chest, and, you know, I knew, and it was more than a decade before we talked about it and the specifics, but at the time, I really felt like he must be a very unlucky outlier, you know, that this was just, you know, horrible bosses that he worked for. Most people could never relate. And it was only a couple years later that I scored what I thought was a dream job. It was my first job out of college. And I was working for a sports management company. Sports was my passion. And what happened was I had a great experience at the headquarters. But then when I took a full-time job at a subsidiary, it was a really toxic place. And I saw firsthand what it did to people. Not only, you know, the consequences we talked about and the contagion piece of it, but I saw that people took it home with them. So it wasn't only hurting the workplace. It was hurting people's lives. You know, it was like, and I just felt like we could and should do better. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was my economics background as an undergraduate or what, but I felt like, okay, you know, there's moral argument to this, but sure. I think the better thing would be to show as objectively as possible what are the costs of this and why should organizations in particular and leaders pay attention to this. And so it really set me on a mission. I went back and got my PhD, you know, kind of focusing on this research, and was fortunate to work with people that were like Christine Pearson, who was already, you know, thinking of this issue and writing on it, that, you know, it really kind of changed the trajectory of my life, not much less my career.
It's interesting. Okay, so we always close the podcast asking for our guests for a yes and story. So the principle in improvisation is that you get nowhere if you say no, and yes but is like a no with a bow tie. So you go to yes and. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Yeah, I think the big one would be in college I tried to pull off trying to play two Division I sports, and I was very undersized, about 5'4". So I was, you know, trying to play soccer and basketball. I was not, you know, I did not look the part necessarily, at least when it came to basketball. So I wasn't sure, you know, if it would work out, and it was not the norm, but it was a fantastic experience, and it challenged me and made me really disciplined, and we made the NCAA tournament, which was an awesome experience, but probably most importantly was it was like a family. You know, it provided good relationships and great learning experiences for me.
Wow. So I literally had this conversation with my daughter in the car because she wants to play volleyball. She wants to go to NYU, play volleyball, but also be an actor. So she wants to play. And I'm like, that's a lot. I might need to have you talk to her.
That would be great. No, it's, I think it really kind of, you know, it forces you to be very disciplined. And there are great things that you get out of both. So that's very cool. I hope he does it.
Me too. All right. The book is called Mastering Civility, A Manifesto for the Workplace. Christine Porath, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.